So it's really good to sit with you to practice together. I know there's a lot of energy and gearing up for the talk, but I try not to lose track of the overall just enjoyment of sitting and practicing together. I just got back from teaching. For the past several years, I've co-taught the women's retreat at IMS. So I just got back from that, and so 96 women, many of whom have been practicing together for decades. It's quite something. But while I was there, I reflected on this poem and life of Patachara, the poem that I read. So she was one of the early Buddhist nuns, and such a powerful story. So the poem I read is her awakening poem, and tonight the theme is awakening, or the third noble truth. So this was her utterance, or her exclamation after a significant mind shift. But what the poems don't reveal, they are a moment in time, but all of the context and kind of readying and ripening that was happening before that shift of mind. So Patachara, as many of you, some of you probably know, had as many women at the time of the Buddha, the stories that are included in the early Buddhist teachings, very difficult lives and came to the path through grief, through the loss of family members, the death of a newborn, relatives. Many of the women came just with a sense of profound grief. And Patachara happened to cross paths with the Buddha, who came to her with a lot of kindness and compassion and understanding, inviting her to recover her presence of mind, to remember her capacity for awareness. And she started practicing diligently. But there's this moment in the poem, so she had been practicing for some time. And I love this poem because it speaks to this process of cultivation. Like, I'm doing everything right. Like, I'm planting the seeds, I'm watering them. But there can be this expectation, like, where's my payoff? Where are the results? I've been doing this for, 2 weeks. I've been doing this for 20 years, for 40 years. Where's my harvest, as she says in the poem. And then she doesn't stop there, but she gathers her mind into the present moment, starts to just watch the unfolding stream of experience moment by moment, just watching the way, very simple action of water going over her foot as she's bathing. And in that concentrated moment, she experiences this going out of craving and clinging, or the clinging mind letting go. So all by itself, the flame went out. And I'll talk about this a little bit more tonight, but why I also wanted to bring in Patachara, her story and her awakening, is that as I was reflecting on this for teaching last week, I was reading the commentary. One contemporary Buddhist teacher's commentary on Patachara's story, and that teacher is Anna Douglas, who wrote a commentary in a wonderful book called The Hidden Lamp, 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. And this is filled with awakening stories, from all three Buddhist traditions. And these are not just nuns, but these are tea ladies. These are grandmothers. These are courtesans. These are wanderers on the side of the road, all awakening in their own way, and describing it in their own way. And as the contemporary teachers reflect on it in their own words, for me, over the past many years, this has felt like an ongoing conversation. Like we're in conversation with these women from the time of the Buddha and beyond. And also, the woman, the teacher who was reflecting on Patacharo was Anna Douglas, who I found out the next day had died several days ago. So she's a teacher at Spirit Rock, 86 years old. One of the first women at Spirit Rock to encourage the inclusion of female figures into the Dharma Hall. Right? And brought her art and creativity and uniqueness to the expression of the Dharma in our lineage, which is like an ongoing conversation. So there's a little posting on the Spirit Rock website and said that she died at home with her glasses and a book of poetry next to her on the bed. Yeah. So I hope we feel as though, I feel as though when we're invited into this practice, which has as its deepest potential awakening, transformation, however, in whatever frame we want to use for that, whatever words we want to use for that, that it is that we are part of kind of an ongoing conversation, lineage, heritage, that has many different expressions and understandings. So I hope we can feel a part of that richness, that this is not just an individual, independent endeavor. Yeah, it's part of an ongoing stream. So just wanted to include a little bit of Patacharo and also recognize and honor Anna Douglas. So this third Noble Truth, so that's our theme for the month. And how many people have attended talks on the third Noble Truth already this month? Totally fine if you have not. Okay, great. So about half. So many of you know the kind of overall formula of the Four Noble Truths, or the heart of that teaching is that suffering exists. It's the first. There is a cause. The cause is the deep-seated tendency to cling, to crave and cling. That's the second. There is an end. That's the third. There is an end to craving and clinging and also to suffering. There is an end. And the fourth is the path to that end. So it's said that people tend to have a preference for either the first or the third. I don't know if this has to do with temperament or just where our inclinations lie, but people, as they practice, I've heard, tend to either be overly focused on this truth of suffering, or tend to be overly focused on the ending of suffering, on the goal, the aim, the ultimate potential or possibility. But this is one list in which it's really best if they're all considered together, right? You can't take one out of context. You can't just say that there's a first noble truth. It makes no sense to just say that there's suffering. There is also an end. Likewise, if we just emphasize the end, kind of the direction we're aiming, the possibility, the potential, the freedom, we can miss the opportunity of seeing the movement of suffering and clinging at more subtle levels in this very moment, right? So that can be a movement of craving and clinging itself, being too focused on where the practice is pointing and less on what is right in front of us, what's moving through our minds at this moment. So the third noble truth is said to be like the good news of Buddhism. I don't know the Christian tradition very, very well, but this is supposed to be the good news. And it is very helpful to remember kind of the direction we're pointing or the ultimate kind of aim of where we're pointing. If we're too invested in just the first noble truth, it can start to feel like a slog and drudgery, right? It can start to feel very heavy, like a daily tour through the hindrances, you know, and less of a sense of possibility in terms of where the practice is leading. So this third noble truth, the invitation is that we realize it. We don't just think about it or contemplate it, but that we realize it. We experience it. So going through retreat with these women last week, many of you will be familiar that the end of retreat, there's often this kind of retreat glow that people have, and sometimes it lasts for a little while, sometimes it lasts for a long time. But it's so interesting because in this, because after this week of diligence and putting aside distractions and also things that we get entangled with, there's a lightness and a glow and a warmth and a kind of freedom in the heart and mind. And it's always funny because it happens regularly, you know, it is a known thing. But people often are tempted to attribute this to the environment or to the teachers. But what's actually happening is there has been a process of intentionally and regularly releasing clinging and craving throughout the week, right? So it actually has more to do with the process that somebody has been undergoing. And certainly the conditions and the teachings are helpful in that. But sometimes we miss that process of what is actually happening, the releasing or the lightening or the cooling of the fires. And I'll talk about that in a minute as we go. So so Nibbana is often talked about as in terms of what it's not, right? So it's talked about as the unconditioned, right? The unmanifest, the timeless, the deathless, right? So it's describing a process, not a place. This is helpful. It's describing a process and not a place that we get to. But I think it's very helpful and skillful, actually, that the Buddha mostly talked about it in terms of what it's not. Because the only way we can approach it or start to understand it is by, in some ways, comparing it to a condition we know well or are familiar with. So Einstein said famously that no problem can be solved by the same level of consciousness that created the problem, right? So to try to conceive of Nibbana is in some ways an exercise of infutility, because the mind that is stuck and bound can't conceive of it, right? But what we can know, so there's a great deal of not knowing, being willing to not know, not believe blindly, but being willing to not know and experiment. But what we can know is this experience of being constricted, being held, being bound, and what it's like when that lessens and loosens. You know? What it's like to feel like we're carrying a heaviness or a weight, and what is it like when it feels like for even moments at a time we can put that down? Maybe we pick it back up again, but for moments of time we can recognize, oh, right now the mind is at ease. Right now suffering is not present. Right now, there's a sense of peace. So we can start to really get a feel for this process, and this is what the Third Noble Truth invites us into. So even though it's often talked about as awakening of a verb, happens gradually, or enlightenment, the process of transforming, it's most often referred to as kind of what it's not, right? In kind of in contrast to something else. So this has been a helpful framing for me. So this framing, literally, of Nibbana, as it's translated, it literally means going out. Just going out. And it's meant to refer to the fire, like in the poem of Patachara, like a fire or a flame being extinguished. And so it's not an attaining of something or an adding, but of something being released or freed or going out. So in particular, the fire is said to be the fires of greed, of hatred, and delusion. So those energies in the mind that lead us to wanting, not seeing clearly. So when those fires go out or fade, it's said that that is not a moment of annihilation where something is, something is destroyed or dead, but it is like an extinguishing or a going out. So it's not as though there's a ceasing of existence, but there's a relinquishing or a going out of that fire of greed, of hatred, and delusion. So what's helpful with this analogy is to imagine India, for those who have traveled in warm places. And I lived there for a while, and the heat was the most extreme I had ever experienced. There were literally days of fire, in which it felt as though I was literally inside an oven, you know, like being cooked from the inside. And in those kind of environments, cool and dark and shade is extremely appealing, right? You want nothing more than to be in a cool, dark place that is not hot, right? So if you think about that context, then the Buddha choosing this Nibbana as a going out or a cooling makes a lot of sense. So it's talked about as going out, but also cooling. So the process of heat that's being cooled. So there's a wonderful short little teaching by Ajahn Buddhadasa, who's a Thai forest master, and he talks about this Nibbana as something that happens to rice, right? So it's like, if the rice is too hot, you need to set it aside so that it's Nibbana'd for a while, right? So that it's cooled off for a while. So anyway, he has these great expressions about the importance of letting things cool. So a goldsmith, I think, is the other analogy, who is changing lead into gold, and as it's melting, it needs to cool. You know, it needs to cool so it can be used, so it can be malleable. So we can experience this directly, the sense of our what is so easily inflamed in us, aggravated in us, agitated in us, caught in us, a sense of being kind of cooled or going in the direction of ease, of peace, of letting go. So this is Buddhadasa again. Any reactivity that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. Although it may be a temporary quenching, a temporary cooling, it still means Nibbana. This indeed is the temporary Nibbana that sustains the lives of beings who are still hanging on. If the reactive states exist night and day, no being could endure it. You ought to consider carefully the fact that life can survive only because there are periods when the afflictions don't roast it, which in fact outnumber the times when the afflictions blaze. This kind of Nibbana nurtures us until it becomes the most ordinary habit of life and mind. So this is important to recognize, that we are not inflamed all the time, right? That no human being could endure that. That there are moments when the fires cool. Right? So it's said that when we see something, we hear something, we remember something, that if we are kind of aggravated or agitated or caught by what it is that we see and remember and hear and interact with, it's like a little brush fire. It's like something catches fire, and we'll be able to feel that. We'll feel ourselves getting hooked. You know, we see something, we hear something, and immediately we're drawn into a little world in which we're hooked, where there's kind of like a little fire that starts, a whole like flame of reactivity starts. But that cannot be operating all the time. We couldn't endure it. So the invitation of the third noble truth is to notice when the mind is not inflamed. Notice whatever skillful means we need to employ to kind of cool it, but also when that grasping goes out, or when the flames are cooled. So we see this too in the hindrances, right? So these are forms of grasping that are very familiar to meditators, right? So the Buddha said, when we experience being freed from desire, wanting another pleasant experience, it's like coming out of debt. Yeah. It's like being in debt. I don't know about you, but there have been moments when I have paid off a credit card debt, and that feels extraordinary, right? So being freed of desire, when we come out of that relationship with experience, it is like coming out of debt. Coming out of the grip of ill will, watching ourselves in a kind of negative spiral of frustration, irritation, negativity, then feeling ourselves be able to put that down or not continue it or feel it fade is described as it's like recovering from an illness. Suddenly you're well, like a spell has lifted. Coming out of sloth and torpor or sluggishness, extreme sluggishness of mind, is like being let out of prison, some kind of release of imprisonment. Similar with anxiety and worry, and coming out of doubt is like crossing a desert. Yeah, and suddenly you're through it. You're through this kind of feeling of being parched, unclear. So with all of these experiences of the hindrances or afflictions fading, there's an experience of relief, of release, of appreciation, of even joy. So, and as Buddhadasa says, these can be temporary experiences that we may miss. They can last for a moment. They can last for a long period of time. They can last permanently. So the practice moves in the direction of a complete extinguishing of suffering. So in one conversation, the Buddha's talking to some practitioners, some monks, and he's saying, he's explaining how valuable it is to practice with the Four Noble Truths. And he said, imagine there was somebody who was shooting you with darts 100 times in the morning, 100 times in the middle of the day, and 100 times in the evening. And then imagine that that were happening every day for 100 years. But at the end of that 100 years, you would learn about the possibility of the Four Noble Truths, that kind of shift in possibility when we practice in this way. And the Buddha said, you should take that. Like, that is a good deal. You know, that is a good deal. So always thought that that was extreme, but also very interesting. Because this kind of way of being in pain and this way of relating to suffering, it's said to have gone on, like there is no beginning to it, right? There is no beginning to it of responding and reacting to life, to our lives in a way that compounds our suffering. But this perspective of practice actually gives us a way to work with it, to alleviate it, to cool it and extinguish it. So this is the good news, right? This is the good news of Buddhism. I want to just offer a couple more ways that have been really helpful for me in approaching this. And then I'd love to hear from you. But this noticing the fading or the cooling or the moment in which we are freed is really vital, especially to our daily life practice. Another framework comes from science and has more to do with what happens in our brains as we learn how to work with reactivity. And this has more alignment with the metaphor that the Buddha also uses for the third noble truth as entering a stream. It's the metaphor of entering a stream. So Dan Siegel, wonderful scientist, researcher, MD, talks about our relationship with experience and bringing awareness to experience as a balance point in which we're aware of the flow of the present moment's experience, similar to a river, and noticing how often we are caught on one bank or the other. So one bank is an approach to the uncertainty of the change, the present changing, uncontrollable moment. One approach to it, one bank of the river, is rigidity, yeah? Our attempt to control and manage and make things kind of more to our liking. So as we're flowing down the banks of the river, we'll find ourselves at times grasping, clenching on the side of rigidity. We'll be able to feel that, getting solid, creating an identity around trying to manage uncontrollable experience, govern the ungovernable. At other times, we'll find ourselves on the other bank, which is chaos. On this side, it's like we conclude, there's nothing to be done. Why even try? It's all too much. So on this side, we tend towards overwhelm, towards a lack of influence or intervention, and kind of a passive succumbing to chaos. But right in between those two, and we may find ourselves occasionally on either bank, and we can create identities on either bank. The rigid, we may identify with we are the manager of experience. We are the controller. We are running the show. On the other side, we may identify with the one to whom everything is happening. More of the victim of experience. It's all happening to me. There isn't anything I can do about it. We may be prone to discouragement, despair. There's nothing I can do. Right? But I am not a scientist, but Dan Siegel, others who've researched it, said that when our brains are integrated, our minds are integrated, the experience is one of being in touch with the flow of the present moment's experience without needing to bank on the sides of chaos or rigidity. Right? We stay in the flow of the present moment's experience. Yeah. And we relinquish our views that have been bound up with how it appears on either side. So as we enter the stream, we give up the view of ourselves as the center of that experience. We also give up any doubt that this stream is going in a helpful direction, right? Is going in a direction that has our deepest well-being at the center. And we give up any belief that it is the practice, that it is any kind of rites or rituals that create it. There may be many things that help us remember this sense of a stream or the sense of a path, but it's not, it doesn't create it, right? It, our skillful means and our practices may help us become aware of it in a sustained way, but they do not create it, right? So, so in a way, the path is right there in the middle, through this present moment. We're not in charge of it. We also need not be flooded by it, right? And the last way, so I'll just close with this. The last way or approach to the Third Noble Truth or awakening is what they say in the Zen tradition as awakening is an appropriate response. Yeah. Awakening is an appropriate response. And I love this and appreciate this very much. And I think we can feel the truth of this. And hopefully we've experienced some examples of people responding beautifully and well to challenging circumstances. Again, it's easy for us to glom on to the response part and try to figure out our response in our minds, right? I need to know what to do. You know, this world in crisis, this world on fire, this world burning, what do I do? I need to know how to respond. Without seeing that the responses, the appropriate responses arise out of a mind that is cooled, that is calmed, that is able to see multiple perspectives, that is not banked on the side of chaos or rigidity, that in that open mind, there are a number of creative possibilities. There is playfulness. There is responsiveness. There is an appropriate response that is not pre-planned ahead of time. So I hope we can get a sense of this. This is not a perfect response. It is appropriate in that it takes into account all of the different factors of the situation. And arises out of a mind that is, if not cooled, maybe cooling, okay? If not completely awakened, awakening. So this is very helpful to get a sense of. And There are a lot of stories that I could potentially end with, and this often happens. It's like a choose your own adventure. I've got three or four possible endings, but I want to end with something that just makes it for this very concrete, how we can really experience this, because we're talking about the fruits of our practice, right? Where it points. Came home this week after this week away of on the women's retreat. I came home and I felt like there were a lot of wholesome things in my mind. There was a lot of appreciation, a lot of generosity, a lot of natural kindness and care. And I came home and it's always a process of weaving back into the household stream after being away. And my son is in a new period of being very diligent with household chores, which I celebrate. This is a good part of the independence, is like seeing his list of things he has to do and checking them off. And one of those lists is laundry. And so I had unpacked my suitcase from teaching for the week and hadn't gotten to the laundry yet. So in his zeal, he put almost every item of clothing that I have in the wash at the same time with the dog blankets and silk scarves, wool pants, dark clothes, light clothes, dog items, all in the wash at the same time. Said, "This is the most full I've ever gotten it," and like with such delight. And so when I realized this, I noticed my mind, and there was a moment where I could see a potential fire burning, where I could see multiple pathways that I could possibly go down in that moment. Irritation, exasperation, fear, so many different pathways, rigidity, chaos, despair. I'm using a very mundane example, so hopefully it will be relatable. But more than anything, I could feel multiple possibilities, right? And the ability to navigate in between them. To some degree, the ability to choose. But more than that, I could see that is a direction of suffering, and that is not. Yeah, that is a direction that goes nowhere. You know, how could you do this? What were you thinking? This is, you know, or, oh no, you know, catastrophizing. I could clearly see that those were dead ends, that those, you know, and it wasn't a rational process, but I could see that is not helpful. I could also appreciate the many wholesome moments, the wholesome aspects of his mind, of my mind in the present moment. And there was great appreciation for the practice and the possibilities that practice allowed in that moment. So there was, it was not happy, but there was a kind of Dharma joy in that moment at knowing that there are possibilities, right? And knowing that there was some fruit of having practiced that brought that into being. So there's still laundry hanging everywhere in my house, right? There is still follow-up in terms of training about how to do laundry and what it means to have a full load and which things need to be sorted and so on. But there isn't a sense of suffering around it, right? So I use a mundane, non-political example to hopefully just show you that these Four Noble Truths, especially the possibility of the ending of craving, clinging, and suffering, we can recognize it in a moment. We can get a taste for it, a feel for it, and we can also recognize the possibility, if only the possibility, that these tendencies could be uprooted, could be extinguished for all time. Yeah. We can entertain that possibility and that sense of unknown. All right, why don't we just sit quietly for a moment? And as we sit, we can just let these words settle. So these different approaches of cooling, of entering the stream, and of an appropriate response. So I appreciate your attention tonight. Hope some of that was useful. And I'd love to hear from you. So some of you may have been contemplating this all month. For some people, maybe it's the first time, but I'd love to hear your own reflections or particular any questions. Could be about this or anything you're working with in your own practice, experimenting with. Yes, it's.
I shared this example on Sunday morning when we were talking about this, and I hadn't really, when it came up, I hadn't really realized that it really was a moment of freedom. So I have a fairly new relationship, and the mind does all this stuff of this is wrong and that's wrong and you shouldn't talk that way. And I, you know, and we had been in a kind of had a difficult conversation, so we got back together again to follow up on this difficult conversation of where is this relationship. And what I said was, I'd like us to be closer. And then this person said, oh, I'd like that too. And it was letting go of all of the lists and the mind's judgments about this, and also trying to like project into the future. Well, if only this, your behavior was this way, every, you know, and all that. Instead, it would just got to like the kernel of the desire and the aspiration was just to deepen the friendship. And when it happened, and both of us have since talked about it, it felt so good. There was no suffering there. It was really just, oh, right. It was simple. It was just, and yeah, so, and joyful. I just wanted to share that to kind of get to a simple place was part, it was for me an appropriate response.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, thank you, Suze. Yeah. And that also feels to me like the arising of wisdom also, the wisdom and clarity that can see, like, what's at the heart of this? Or what's at the center of this? And can recognize there's just a kind of cutting through, like a compassionate cutting through in what you described, like, oh, at the heart of it is just a longing to connect. And when we hit that, when we recognize that, when suddenly that wisdom dawns, there is a joyful sense of being released. But we didn't do it. It wasn't us that did it. It was like wisdom arose, saw the situation, the heart of it, and then that the rest could fall away on its own. So I love that example because so many of our relational moments are like that, right? Very confusing and conflicting needs and desires. And so it's a wonderful question to ask, you know, both of ourselves or in a relational, like, what's at the heart of this? What's really most important here? That can cut through a lot. So thank you. And then the response is effortless. We don't have to, do a lot of, strategizing. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so the alternative is to go into small groups and talk about moments of freedom. So we could. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay, Deb. Deb has something. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Carrie.
Yeah.
I have a story to tell about this. It has to do with the function of my ego. Ha ha. And before I moved here to this little island that I live on now, and being closer to Sims, and I would be there, you know, on Monday nights, and I'd be kind of, you know, before we were in this space that you're sitting in now, you know, I'd be scurrying around, doing this, doing that, feeling like, well, I'm a pretty important person, you know, because I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm checking the mail, I'm doing this, all these functions, very important person. And it was really a struggle. I mean, it's a kind of a drag to put that burden on me. So I say that's ego function, or is it becoming, the sense of becoming? And I took some pride in that, certainly, like, oh, I'm pretty important around here, you know, I'm checking the mail, I'm doing this. But at the same time, it was a stress. For sure. And I remember one day walking out of the building where you all are now and walking up the street towards the bus station and just feeling like, you know, I can just be an ordinary person, just another yogi walking down the street, you know, and it's just quiet here and I'm just another person in this city walking to the bus, nobody special, nothing outstanding, nothing to do, nothing to, just an ordinary person. And it was so freeing. And I think the cessation that I experienced was of the ego dropping away and saying, you don't need to become anything, you know. You could just be just the person walking down the street, nothing special, nothing extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And it was such, this weight just lifted. Mm-hmm. I just remember that so clearly. It was such a relief, mm-hmm. not to have to become. something. I don't know what I was supposed to become, but yeah. Yeah, it just, it fell away. And now sometimes I still climb back into that. You know, it is not a permanent alteration, but it was so clear and I do remember it very distinctly.
That's right. And that the contrast of that really stands out, that dropping away. And even though it may come back, it's like our perspective has changed after that, right? Because before it might have just felt like the water we swim in, or might just felt like how things are. So we almost don't understand it fully until it lifts or it drops or it cools. And then we can look back and say, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you.
I think.
Oh, is there a...
I may be misrecalling, but I think last year you talked at some point about practicing like your hair is on fire. and I was thinking about how I am very project-oriented, very goal-oriented, and I apply it to this area of my life as well. I have a friend who's a meditation teacher who's been advising me to not make things into a project. And so when I hear you talk, and I, in my ignorance and delusion, interpret having my hair on fire as being like, I'm going to work really hard not to do the second arrow, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm going to just make this another project. Mm. And I hear you talking about the side of the bank, that's the rigidity. And I think that's where I am with that type of very, seems like a very Western approach to the practice. And so it's very calming, and it feels like I'm getting a little more clarity about, because when somebody tells you don't do the projects, then I think, well, what's the other way to do this? But I'd love to have a little more insight on what I do with the hair on fire part. What sense do I make of that with what you're talking about tonight?
That's great. Yeah, it's wonderful. And, you can only take the similes and metaphors so far, right? And sometimes they contradict each other. So sometimes that image or that perspective is helpful if we are in a period of complacency or we're kind of drifting. There isn't, it's meant to arouse a sense of urgency, right? It's meant to, like, no time to lose. Anything could happen at any moment, which is always true. But some of us don't need that kind of emphasis at all. That is, like, with us all the time. We do not need reminders of that. So it's like picking up the right medicine at the right time, right? Your hair already feels like it's on fire. You don't need to set it on fire again, right? In this way, there's a wonderful kind of not knowing that I think most people come to in practice, which is a lot of the tools and skills that I've been developing in other areas might not work here. You know, I had somebody who had been an ER physician for her whole career say in her first retreat, I'm starting to get the sense that something else might be needed in terms of approach when I come to meditate, as like, you know, putting out, you know, attending to all these things. So it's wonderful to say, I don't know how to do this. You know, I don't know how to do this. This is not my usual way of going about things, but I do know that that my usual kind of stance is exhausting. And that's more of the first noble truth, that I do know that this pushing and constantly projecting my life is exhausting. So, okay, let me just be with that and just like really recognize that. Just for a moment, let me just be with that. Okay. There's a moment of projecting, a moment of stressing, a moment of tightening, have to be, have to get it right, have to get to the next thing, got to finish this. You know, we know that, know what that feels like. Yeah. And there are moments when that's not happening too, you know, because we can't live like, I'm not just speaking to you. Imagine many people can relate. So there are also moments when that is not operative. So to notice that also. Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Something happened tonight when I was listening to you in the talk. I really spent the day today just heavy despair about the world situation. And, you know, a friend kind of named a quality of casting about that it wasn't just the despair about the situation, but the what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And that was definitely like almost more the level of despair, not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
Than the actual thing. I don't think I really realized it until when you talked about awakening as an appropriate experience or appropriate response. That was how you put it. Awakening is the appropriate response or an appropriate response. And I just realized like, oh, I haven't been trusting myself. I don't. That flailing, that casting about is like a lack of trust.
Yeah, it's like classically doubt. Casting about is perfect description of doubt. Like, oh no, what should I do? Is this right? I don't know. This might not be right. Is it right? But yeah, casting about is a perfect description. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what was it like to recognize that?
It just it felt I'm smiling because I want to say it felt warm. But I think if the Buddha were from our
that's right.
climate, we might have been talking about warming up and melting rather than.
That's funny because that's what the British, you know, all the monasteries in England, that was their comment too, that warmth is a lot more appealing in the winter in England, you know,
yeah.
Images of warmth.
Warm so, and yeah. Just clearer, lighter.
Lighter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the seeing itself was clearer and lighter. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Thanks for verbalizing that. Yeah.
This will sound odd, but I had a moment of awakening in the bathroom.
Great.
It was when, after the meditation, and I walked down the hall, and I could feel myself going, okay, I need to create a self right now. So I look at people, and I smile, you know, I could feel it just all coming up. And I was in the bathroom, and I thought, you know, I could let that go. I could just be myself, just be an ordinary person and not have to create all this. So it's kind of funny that we have this conversation now because it was really like, oh, that's it? That's all I have to do? So thank you.
Yeah. And what was the feeling of it, that recognition of, sounds like relief.
Absolute relief. And it was like, I could do this more often. I can be just aware when I'm making that person up.
That's right. And so to not make that into an enemy or any kind of really big deal, but you know, when teacher talks about that sense of self is just an option. And you can just decide, sometimes it's within our awareness to decide, like, oh, I don't have to pick that up. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can try something else. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, should we call it good for tonight? All right. Okay. Right, really appreciate the comments and reflections tonight. So, as always, please take what's useful and leave the rest. And hope you can take some of these reflections into your own in your own life over the next especially week or two, but just noticing that moment of putting down, those moments when there is choice, when things lift, and those are also practice moments. Those are also practice moments. As always, I really appreciate your reflection on Donna, just to have some regular practice of just remembering it and without any sense of force or expectation or obligation, but as a way of just offering freely and joyfully what you can to support my livelihood as a teacher, our livelihood as teachers, and also the ongoing support for Seattle Insight, so we can continue to offer programs and have things run well at the center. So I encourage you to reflect on that in your own way. I think there's something in the chat. Most of you have that information, but if you need any clarification, you can talk to me or likely many other people around. Okay. So thank you. Thank you for your practice tonight. I appreciate your sincerity and willingness to be here to speak and share and reflect together.